This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jad Abumrad, is the producer of Radiolab, a nationally broadcast public radio show and podcast that originates from WNYC in New York. He's considered to be a radio genius, like Ira Glass. As evidence, Jad is the recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship, the so-called Genius Award. For about 17 years, he co-hosted Radiolab with Robert Krulwich. They started off doing deep dives into science-related stories with highly produced narratives in which the voices were almost scored like music. Composing film scores was Jad's initial aspiration. The show's focus evolved from stories about science-based reality to conflicting versions of truth and reality. Robert Krulwich retired from the show last year. Jad continues to produce the show and co-reports Radiolab's miniseries. The podcast series Dolly Parton's America, co-reported by Jad, won 7 awards, including a Peabody. It used her life, music, theme park, and personality to get to larger issues about messy relationships, women's rights, how the Civil War continues to play out, and how music can bring together people who otherwise might disagree on nearly everything. The new Radiolab miniseries is called The Vanishing of Harry Pace. You may be thinking, Harry who? It's one thing to get people interested in a miniseries about Dolly Parton, but how do you get listeners to believe that a miniseries about a man they've never heard of is worth their time? Here's how. From the opening episode, this is Jad talking about Harry Pace's grandchildren, who grew up knowing very little about Pace, except that he was white and probably Italian.
What they discovered is that this man, Harry Pace, whose picture had been hanging on their wall their whole lives,
well, first of all, he wasn't Italian.
It turns out that he was African-American.
He was black.
That's how he identified. That's how he was seen.
And he was someone who literally changed America.
In like 19 different ways.
Music.
Culture.
Theater.
Housing.
Law.
He proceeded to fight the case all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States.
The decision opened 500 new properties to black residents.
He desegregated whole neighborhoods, laid the groundwork for so much music.
Like without him,
we'd have no Robert Johnson.
Please allow me to introduce myself.
No Rolling Stones and no Eric Clapton.
Singing, I love rock and roll.
He even had a hand in coining the term rock and roll.
I mean, this dude's, good God, why don't we have like 3 movies about this dude, right? I mean, you know, hello, Ava DuVernay, right? Good God, I mean, this dude is like, he is like the vocational MacGyver.
But then somehow, right at the peak of his power,
it's like, poof.
He vanishes.
So completely that none of us know his story. Not even his own family.
Wow. So you're telling me we're related to this unsung hero and you want me to just sit here and laugh about it? I gotta go understand this.
Okay, Jad Abumrad, welcome to Fresh Air. I'm so glad I heard this series. It's really just fantastic, and congratulations on it. And I want to start giving a shout out to Shima Oliayi, who co-reports the series with you.
I'm sorry, Terry, it's just, I just got to tell you, like, I do what you do, and it's just such an honor to be here, because you are the best, and so I'm just really excited.
Oh, gee. Oh, thanks. I'm excited to have you. So I just have to say, there's so much to talk about with you. And I couldn't figure out how to start exactly. Do you go through that when you're about to start a project? Like, where do you begin? Like, what's the right note to start on?
Yeah, and actually, I mean, the clip that you played was the 12th beginning of the series.
No, like, I feel better already.
We tried so many. I mean, Shima, who co-created the project with me, like, we tried every different beginning to that series. And I was smiling when you played it because I thought, that actually works. Because so many didn't work.
So my doorway into The Vanishing of Harry Pace was hearing that he founded Black Swan Records, which was like the first black-owned record company, 1921 to 23, first to record Ethel Waters, first to record the black national anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing. I mean, it's just like remarkable recordings. And I'm really interested in music from that period. So I thought, like, yeah, I got to hear this. And then you started taking me in all these other directions, which were equally fascinating, but I was like, not really prepared for it. What was your doorway into wanting to tell this story?
Well, so, you know, you mentioned Dolly Parton's America. So Shima and I had made that series. And And one of the voices in that series was a guy named Paul Slade, who he's this British music journalist who had told us about Appalachian murder ballads. And it was just sort of a small little wrinkle in that 9-part series. And as we were coming off of that series and looking for something new to do, he reached out and said, "Hey, have you heard of Black Swan Records? I just wrote a book about it." And it was a small Kindle book, and we read it. And we both were just blown away it is one of those stories where you think you're hearing a story about a guy who started a label, but then suddenly you're in the middle of a Supreme Court case about desegregating Chicago's South Side. And then suddenly you're in this very complex, troubling drama about the politics of the color line. It's just one of those stories that cuts across everything.
And just to mention here, like, he starts off being mentored by W.E.B. Du Bois. They found what was probably the first black magazine together. Then he works with W.C. Handy. They found a sheet music publishing company and co-write St. Louis Blues and Beale Street Blues. I mean, it's just a remarkable story. And then there's a whole racial story in there about what color was he really.
Yeah.
Embedded in this story is a bit of a personal connection for you. One of the grandsons talks about his racial confusion because he grew up thinking he's white, and now he thinks, maybe I'm really black. Like, was my grandfather black? He was very light skinned, but apparently he was really black. But on a census report, he said he was white. So, you know, the grandson is like really confused and asked, like, so what am I? And you say in the podcast that you were asked when you were growing up. So what are you?
Yeah, no, it's a connection that I and my co-creator Shima make very cautiously because, you know, we're both Middle Eastern, and you walk into a room and people think you're one thing, then they hear your name and they think you're another thing, and then they give you that look. It's a look you recognize. We're like, what are you? Are you some vaguely ethnic kind of person? And I think of it as the sort of the curse/gift of the in-betweeners, you know, where no one can quite fit you into a box that they've got in their head. That comes with a sort of a irritation and also a little bit of a privilege, depending on which room you're standing in and who you're speaking to. But it's something that it's funny. Every story I tell, it occurred to me in the middle of this project, it has something of that in-betweener spirit in it. You know, people who don't fit, people whose identity or whose work or whose creative spirit somehow doesn't quite sit in the predefined categories. So that was my personal connection, but it's also kind of a professional journey that I just feel like I've been on for the last 20 years.
Well, your parents immigrated from Lebanon during the Lebanese Civil War. Was it 82 that they came here?
They came here in 72, actually.
Oh, 72. So, okay.
Yeah.
Just
before I was born, and just as the war was really starting to slide into chaos.
In Lebanon.
Yeah.
So you grew up in Tennessee. Your father's a professor of surgery at Vanderbilt?
That's right, yeah.
So were you like a campus kid?
Yeah, I was. I mean, my after school was basically hanging out. So both my parents my mother's a molecular biologist, my dad's a surgeon. And my after school was hanging out in her lab and playing with her lab rats and just sitting there for hours. Or I'd hang out at his at Vanderbilt where he works, and I would play pool with the med students. So yeah, I was kind of the campus kid. I was just sort of like the lab kid who was just always around.
Radiolab initially focused on science. Was part of the reason why you wanted to do that because you grew up partially in this lab? And was science more fun because you had rats? Like, you had little animals to watch. It wasn't just like test tubes and textbooks.
Well, yeah. I mean, I it's funny. Like, I only later did I realize that the rats were, you know, the rats that I would pet and give names to and let them, I would put them in my pockets. Only later did I realize that they would later be sacrificed to science.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, fast forwarding to those early days of Radiolab where I became kind of essentially a science reporter, part of it was about coming back into the family fold in some sense. I had grown up in the environment of science my entire life, but I didn't really understand what they did. I didn't understand what happens in a lab, where the core of my mother's research. I couldn't have explained it to you. And so it was actually really exciting in the early days to ask them questions and to really understand, oh, that's how science works. Interesting. You know, my mother has been studying one protein for almost 40 years, one single protein. And every year she discovers it has some new job that it does. You know, year one, oh, it helps fat get into cells. Year two, oh, it helps you taste things on your tongue. Year three, oh, it's in the heart and it does something about, you know, fatty acids and yada yada. I mean, every year she discovers some new job it has. I had never till that point really stopped to think about that process and to think about the patience and the focus that it takes. And so it was really cool to be a science reporter and then be able to turn to these two people and ask them questions that simultaneously, A, helped my work, but B, also explained my childhood in some sense. So, yeah.
So this kind of segues into Dolly Parton, because your doorway into Dolly Parton was in part the fact that she and your father, the surgeon, became friends. So just tell the story of how they met.
Yeah, it's just one of those strange, you know, the universe is stranger than you can imagine kind of moments. So I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, and Nashville is Dolly's world. I mean, I guess the world is Dolly's world at this point, but Nashville is like the epicenter of the Dollyverse, and that you walk down the street and she's on a billboard every three blocks and you hear her blaring out of cars and she just kind of infuses the air. And that's the world I grew up in. And then it's either 2003 or 2013, I can't remember exactly, but Dolly gets into a minor car crash, is brought to Vanderbilt Hospital, and my dad happens to be on duty at that moment and takes care of her. And she was fine. Nothing happened to her. And I guess he checked up on her a few times. And then through that, they became friends, which is, even as I say this to you, Terry, it's the strangest thing, because my dad is he's not the kind of guy that hangs out with famous people or country. Like, he's this amazing, incredible guy, but he's just like this Lebanese doctor and suddenly is friends with this global icon. And I had never really believed that to be true. He would mention, oh, I talked to Dolly today. And I'd be like, yeah, right. Sure you did, Dad. But then 2016, this was during the Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump election cycle. Dolly Parton did a concert in Queens. You know, I work in New York. And I was just thunderstruck by how excited everybody I work with was for this concert. And I didn't realize that she had such a grip on New Yorkers. And there was something, then people came back from this concert and they just seemed so, everybody told these stories of how like her concerts were this mishmash of all of these slices of America that apparently are not supposed to get along. Men in drag standing next to men in trucker hats, little girls in sparkly dresses next to women holding hands, next to church ladies. You know, it's just like all of the different people in the culture war that we're told shouldn't get along. They're all there, standing shoulder to shoulder, singing, I Will Always Love You. And I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting, particularly at this moment when politics seemed to be kind of a dumpster fire, right? It just seemed like, oh, this was an alternative American space. And I just was suddenly really interested to know how she does it. So I called my dad and I was like, Dad, do you really know Dolly Parton? Is that true? Because if it is, can you introduce me? And he said, sure. And then I flew to Nashville and, you know, we went to this place and she walked into the room and much smaller than I expected, but also like larger than life in all the ways you expect. And I somehow convinced her, probably largely she did it as a favor to my dad, I should be honest, to be a subject of a series, and the rest is history.
Yeah, it's a fascinating series because you get into so much about race and North-South divisions and what is the meaning of feminism, and it's very, very rich. And you found a very personal connection in her story too. and I want to play a clip from that. You go to Dollywood and you see like a replica of the mountain shack that she grew up in. And you decide, well, I'm going to go to the real shack. So you go to the mountain, you go to the real shack. It's beautiful, beautiful mountain, pristine forest. And you have this memory that seems to be intruding. It's kind of not quite a deja vu, but a rhyme of another memory. And you're puzzling through that, and then you have a realization. So here's the clip in which you describe the realization you had when you were standing in Dolly Parton's shack where she grew up.
The memory that kept intruding was from almost exactly 20 years earlier. I'd gone to Lebanon with my dad for a wedding. This is when I was just getting into recording, so I had my recorder with me everywhere I went. And the day after the wedding, my dad had driven us up the mountains to show us the village where he was born and raised. A little village called Wadi Shahrur. This little enclave where literally half the village has our last name. It's high up in the mountains, actually the exact same elevation as the mountain where Dolly lives. The air sort of has that exact same kind of thinness to it. And when we finally got to see his house, it looked a lot like Dolly.
When I saw her house,
I told him about it later.
It reminded me instantly of your house.
Yeah. It's almost identical like Dolly. There was one bedroom. We were five kids and two parents. And so you put your floor mat and you sleep side to side. And when you wake up in the morning, you stack the floor mats in the corner.
So seven people in one room?
Seven people in one room.
Jesus, how did you even sleep?
You sleep. You learn.
God. Tell me who you are, just so I have your introduction.
What do you mean? I'm Naji Abumrad. I'm your father.
Okay, that's a clip from Dolly Parton's America, co-reported by my guest, Jad Abumrad, who's the creator of Radiolab. I love, you know, later on, when you talk to Dolly Parton in this part of the series, she ends by saying, "You never really know your parents like other people do." And when I heard that, I thought, oh, yeah, that's so true.
Yeah.
So was she, in a way, a doorway to getting to know a part of your father that you otherwise might not have known?
Yeah, it's exactly that. I mean, that line, when she said that to me, it struck me really. It kind of stopped me in my tracks, because she was a doorway. She is a doorway. I mean, there's something very powerful to me, having grown up in Tennessee. You know, I think Dolly and my dad came to stand for a union of two cultures that I had always held as very, very separate. The mountains of Lebanon and that experience, in terms of the immigrant experience, in terms of just the sort of trajectory of coming down the mountain and leaving, but also in terms of the music that flowed from these two places, I had always held all of that stuff to be extremely separate. And it was really, really moving to me to discover that there actually, you know, there are trade routes that run down from the mountains of Lebanon into East Tennessee. There are singing styles, melismatic singing styles that came from the Middle East that influenced Appalachian singing. Certainly the banjo and these kinds of things, you know, these flowed in from Africa through Haiti. It's really moving to me to find that these musical styles are never separate, and that country music is as much mine as anyone's. Now, I can't say I love country music, but it felt really good to know that this music could be mine, and by extension, the culture. You know, it's not the easiest thing to be an Arab, like an awkward, gangly Arab kid growing up in a Southern Baptist universe. And so part of this experience for me, exploring their relationship, was to sort of find my place in Tennessee. And I'm very grateful to the project that it allowed me to do that. And really grateful to my dad that he allowed me to, and Dolly, that they both allowed me to sit there and pester them with all these questions.
Well, Jad, it's really been great to talk with you. I really appreciate it. And I really appreciate your work. So thank you. Thank you for the interview. Thank you for Radiolab and your miniseries and all the great stuff you've done. It opens up your ears and your mind to listen.
Well, thank you. And I'll just say back to you, Terry, you are the person that we all sort of idolize and chase in terms of how to do the job with integrity and thoughtfulness. And it's just such an honor to sit here and speak with you.
Well, you've made my day, my week. Thank you so much. Jad Abumrad is the creator of the public radio show and podcast Radiolab. He co-reports the new Radiolab miniseries, The Vanishing of Harry Pace. Dana Spiota's novels have been shortlisted for most of the major literary awards. Her latest novel is called Wayward. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan says it's a novel about one woman's extreme response to the pervasive low-level panic that marks our own time.
Dana Spiota's new novel, Wayward, is about a 53-year-old woman named Samantha Sam Raymond, who's going through menopause and becomes a little unhinged. She leaves her husband and her teenage daughter in the suburbs of Syracuse and impulsively moves into a dilapidated arts and crafts bungalow in a crumbling downtown neighborhood of that city. If this premise sounds melodramatic, that's not the kind of writer Spiota is. As a longtime fan, I went back and looked at the reviews I've written of Spiota's earlier work. In every review, I've used the word smart. Spiota is one of the most alert, ambitious, nuanced, and yes, smartest of our contemporary novelists. Because Wayward is set in 2017, it's not only about one woman going internally haywire, but about the entire country roiling in the wake of the 2016 election and the rise of the Me Too and Black Lives Matter movements. This story opens on a restless Sam having trouble sleeping. Who among us cannot identify? Here's how Spiota describes Sam's stirred-up psyche. Lately, Sam's desire to be contrary to convention had taken on a new urgency, well beyond clothes or matters of taste. An unruly, even perverse inclination animated her. It had been looking for a place to land, for something to fasten on. So now, this odd inner state pushed her toward a highly destabilizing wildness, a recklessness that she couldn't suppress any longer. Idly scanning the online real estate listings, Sam finds that elusive something to fasten on in an arts and crafts bungalow, complete with leaded windows and a tiled fireplace, advertised for intrepid buyers only. In other words, the place is a charming ruin. After seeing it, Sam decides, in the words of feminist poet Adrienne Rich, to dive into the wreck. Only after she's written out a check for the asking price of $38,000 does Sam realize that saying yes to this version of her life would mean saying no to another version of her life. Spiota's novels, always rich with ideas and atmosphere, often focus on the arts. In her 2011 book, Stone Arabia, The Art is Music. In Innocence and Others, which came out in 2016, film is at the story's center. Here, architecture connects to Wayward's larger meditations about impermanence and decay, human, structural, and even national. As Sam restores her minimally habitable shambles of a house, she's also casting about for answers to how to construct a meaningful life in her 50s, and also how to come to terms with the looming end of things. Meeting up with other white women her own age at political gatherings after the election, alienated Sam disdainfully looks at their carefully angled, highlighted, silvery haircuts and Eileen Fisher linen pants and surrenders to what she calls bouts of midlife misogyny. Fortunately, the Syracuse area is rich in women's history and the nearby presence of iconic women's houses, such as those of Harriet Tubman and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, offer Sam some inspiration from the past. Spioda, however, complicates things by making up a faux 19th century figure she calls Clara Loomis. Loomis went to medical school, fought for suffrage, and regrettably became a proponent of eugenics. Sam uneasily works as a paid guide at the fictional Loomis house and has to deal with the contempt of visitors who dismiss Loomis's accomplishments and flatly label her a proto-Nazi. Inevitably, Sam wonders how she herself will be judged by posterity in the form of her own daughter. On a lighter note, Sam's tour guide patter can be hysterical, in every sense of that word. Here's a snippet of one of her lectures to a high school group. Clara Loomis, in her middle years, after menopause, when having children and rearing children were no longer considerations, started what she called her true life. Sam emphasized the word menopause. She didn't know why, but she felt the urge to scream it at young women sometimes. She imagined herself shrieking, "Menopause, menopause, menopause," but settled for merely enunciating it, because she wasn't a total psycho, not yet. There are subplots here about Sam's ill but resolutely solitary mother and her sophisticated teenage daughter who's losing herself in an erotically charged affair with an older man. But it's the character of Sam herself, messy, hurtful, floundering in late midlife, who's the compelling draw. Recently, I've become aware of the term crossing the Crimson Bridge as a fanciful way to refer to menopause. In Wayward, Spioda endows that passage with all the gravitas and unpredictability it deserves by giving us a heroine who chooses to take a flying leap off the Crimson Bridge into uncharted territory.
Maureen Carrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Wayward by Dana Spioda. Coming up, we hear from Dr. Lena Wen, an emergency care physician, former Baltimore Health Commissioner, CNN medical analyst, and Washington Post contributing columnist. Her new memoir is about emigrating from China as a child, relying on America's public health system for her severe asthma, and how that led her to become an emergency care physician and public health expert. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. You may know my guest, Dr. Lena Wen, from her appearances on CNN, where she's a medical analyst. She's commented extensively on CNN and in her Washington Post column about COVID and the precautions we need to take. She's had a pretty remarkable life, which she writes about in her new memoir, Lifelines, A Doctor's Journey in the Fight for Public Health. She's an emergency medical doctor and served as Baltimore's health commissioner. She spent the first few years of her life in Shanghai, China. Her parents suffered through the Cultural Revolution, and her father spent time in prison for his work as a dissident. When she was nearly 8, she and her father came to the U.S. to join her mother, who was able to move to Utah on a visa to attend grad school. Just before the visa expired, Wen's father was able to obtain political asylum. Dr. Wen, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. It's a great pleasure to join you again.
You became an emergency medicine doctor and public health expert in part because of your experiences as a child with really bad asthma. You had really bad asthma in China. You had to go to the hospital about once a month. And then as an immigrant in the U.S., your family was poor. You relied on public health. You relied on Medicaid and emergency rooms. How aware were you as a child of the relationship between money and access to healthcare?
I was very aware of it, even if I didn't have the words to describe it as you have. And that's because of so many instances in my life when I saw that people didn't have access to care because they couldn't pay for it. I remember there was a neighbor child who was just a couple of years younger than me, who also had asthma. He had a very bad asthma attack, and I remember rushing to help him because his grandmother was screaming for help, and I knew what to do for asthma. I also know how terrifying it is to be struggling to breathe, and I was trying to give my inhaler to this kid, and I knew at some point that he really needed to go to the hospital for treatment. But his grandmother was too afraid to call for help. And actually, because we didn't get help for him in time, he died. I mean, he died in front of me due to this entirely preventable cause. And I mean, even as I think about this now, this image is seared on my mind because I kept on thinking this did not have to happen. I mean, his grandmother was just too afraid to call for help because they were undocumented immigrants and she was afraid of the authorities coming and their family being deported. And I thought at that time, and I remember having a discussion with my mother about this afterwards, that we're in a society where people's lives are valued differently depending on where they come from and whether they have the money to pay for care.
When you were Baltimore's health commissioner, there were so many issues that you had to take on. You were the health commissioner during the time that Freddie Gray died. And just to refresh people's memories who may not remember exactly, Freddie Gray was a 25-year-old black man who was arrested by police, charged with carrying a knife, and taken in a police van. In the back of the van, he was shackled, but he wasn't secured to the van, and he was given what's sometimes called a rough ride, or at least that's what people think, and he broke his neck. His neck was broken during that ride, and he died in the hospital. You were the health commissioner during this time. You know, the death of Freddie Gray was traumatic for so many black people in Baltimore and around the country. There were huge protests in Baltimore. There was also looting. Stores, including pharmacies, were set on fire. So among the things you had to deal with as Baltimore health commissioner was this like massive trauma to people in the city. And just on another level, a lot of people couldn't get their drugs because their pharmacy was burned or looted or closed. So you had to deal with things on that level too. What could you do about that?
Well, it was our job to figure out what to do. I mean, when you're the health commissioner, you don't have a manual that says, here are all the possible things that could happen. And even if we got such a manual, I'm pretty sure that civil unrest followed by the burning and looting and closure of more than 12 of our pharmacies would not have been on that list. But you have to adjust. I mean, I don't know that we could have predicted at all that this is what we would end up doing. But we started hearing these stories in the hours after the unrest about individuals who couldn't get access to their pharmacies. And I have to tell you, it was very frustrating at that time because we knew on the ground that these were individuals who depended on their pharmacy for so much. Yes, it was for their medications, but for many people, this was also where they went for their other supplies or even for their food. And I remember contacting these major pharmacy chains and saying, hey, this happened. Can you help us out? And they would say, but you're in Baltimore. There are dozens of other pharmacies. Can't these people just go to other pharmacies? And look, I could do that. I'm a physician. If I have a prescription at Walgreens, I could easily transfer that prescription to a CVS. I also have a car. I can drive myself to another pharmacy if needed. But what about the 80-year-old who is oxygen dependent, who is in a wheelchair and may not even have a telephone? They don't know what medications they're necessarily on. How are they supposed to figure out this kind of transportation to go somewhere else? And so we ended up setting up a prescription hotline service where anyone could call us 24/7, tell us about what they needed, whether it was food or medicines or supplies, and we would figure out a way to get it to them. We also then realized that people may not know about the service because if you're not monitoring social media, if you're not watching the news, how would you even know this thing existed? So we went to senior buildings and public housing in areas near pharmacies, knocked on doors to let people know about this program. And I'll remember this very well because people had two questions. The first question that we got was, what candidate is this for? This was not election season.
Oh, right.
And that's what people thought. And also we had just, we were talking about 48 hours after the unrest and people really thought we were campaigning. And the second question they asked, and this one really broke my heart, was what survey is this? because I filled out a survey last week. I mean, our residents were telling us that they always saw us there for our needs and not for theirs. And they weren't trying to make some kind of political statement. They were genuinely saying, I don't really, you know, I just filled out a survey. I don't really want to fill out another one. And so I think it really changed the way that we approached our work in Baltimore, not so much from this, we are the health department, we know what you need, as opposed to what is it that you need from us?
While you were Baltimore's health commissioner, you had to deal with the opioid epidemic. Do you feel like as a country we've made progress in treating addiction more as a disease than as a crime that needs to be punished with prison?
Yes, I think we made huge headway. The difference between when I was first appointed to my position in 2014 and now in 2021, I think the conversation, the tide has totally changed. That said, there's still a lot of work for us to do in fighting stigma, in accessing treatment. There's still this NIMBY problem, the not in my backyard problem, that we have to recognize that it's not random people who have the disease of addiction. It's our family members, our friends, our neighbors. And so we need to provide treatment for them. But I also think there's something else. I was at a community meeting in Baltimore where an older African-American gentleman stood up. And this was not long after I declared opioids to be a state of emergency in Baltimore. And this gentleman stood up and just said to me, he said, I really do want to understand why it's suddenly an emergency, when actually Baltimore has been faced with the heroin epidemic, the crack epidemic for decades. And I do think there's a part of this that we have to acknowledge, that when it was Black and brown people in minority communities who were disproportionately affected, we did regard addiction as a crime. And now that the face of addiction has changed more to prescription opioids, to college students and rural areas, again, we really need to be treating addiction as a disease. And so, of course, all these individuals need to be treated too. But we do have to acknowledge that part of the change occurred because the face of addiction changed. And that does tie into the systemic inequities and, frankly, the racism in our healthcare system.
I want to ask you about another personal decision you had to make that has implications for your work as a doctor. Your mother had cancer, and it had metastasized through her body. She went through a lot of chemo. She survived longer than she was expected to, but at some point, she told you that she wanted to die at home. She didn't want more treatment, and she had her DNR, which said that she didn't want to be put on a ventilator to keep her alive or any other, you know, like life-saving things when she was at the point she was going to die pretty soon one way or another. She had pneumonia and was taking antibiotics for that at home. But one day it got really bad. Your father was with her and he panicked and called 911. So she was taken to the hospital and they wanted to put her on a ventilator. And you and your sister are saying, like, you can't do that. That is not honoring her wishes. We have to honor her wishes. And you were the official, what's the word I'm looking for, health surrogate,
healthcare proxy.
Healthcare proxy, yeah. And so you had to be the one who asserted, like, I'm the person who has a, you know, official say here, and I'm telling you, do not put her on a ventilator. But you had to decide first whether you wanted to say that. Can you talk a little bit about what went through your mind at that time?
Well, first, I want to say that my mother was a brilliant woman who actually had anticipated exactly that this could happen. She was young at the time. I mean, she was in her 40s when she was diagnosed with metastatic cancer. She was in her 50s when she died. And so she, you know, she had wanted, of course, to be there for her children. I mean, my little sister is much younger than me. She was 16 when our mother died. Our mother really wanted to see her go to college and graduate. And I think about my mother all the time now, as she was a teacher and loved little kids, and she never had a chance to meet my little kids. But my mother knew what she wanted. And she also knew that it would be very, very, very difficult for our family to honor her wishes unless she made it really explicit. I mean, my mother sat me down, talked me through it. We had many conversations as a family. My mother went to a lawyer, drafted her will, made it very clear what her wishes were. She enrolled herself in hospice care. And It was very clear. It was, no one could possibly question that this is exactly what she wanted, given how she had written everything out. It was legally documented. And yet, when we were in the hospital, and yes, we left hospice because my father understandably saw that my mother was really struggling to breathe and took her to the hospital, so we were no longer in hospice care. But we had all these doctors and nurses around us who I'm sure were well-intentioned, who kept on saying things like, but she's so young, how could you possibly let your mother die? And it was certainly the most difficult decision I made to date. And yet it was definitely the right decision, because it was honoring what my mother had so clearly and explicitly expressed, that she wanted to die in peace. And so my sister, my father, and I sat by her bedside and waited for her breathing to subside without her having to be on a ventilator. And I remember, actually, it was a very busy day that day in the hospital. And I knew that there was all this noise all around us, but there was a nurse who, I suppose, at that point really wanted to make sure she honored our wishes too. And she drew a curtain closed around us. And even though it was really busy, and I'm sure they needed that bed, we were able to spend as much time as we needed with our mother, who died that day.
Your mother really sacrificed so much to get the family to the United States. When you were very young, she basically left home. Her plan was she was going to go to college, get a degree, and then go to graduate school in the U.S. so that she could get a visa and then bring the family over and hope that in one way or another that you would be allowed to stay. So she had to leave the family and live on the college campus, because you were required to live on the college campus to go to college. And you didn't understand all of that. I mean, you were basically raised by your paternal grandparents. And I don't know, you might have thought like, well, mom doesn't really care about me very much. She's not even here. And then she left for the United States, and you and your father didn't join her until later.
We joined her pretty quickly.
Oh, pretty quickly. Okay.
Yeah.
But still, she went first, and I'm
yes,
not sure.
Yes, we didn't know when we would be able to join her. We ended up going to join her pretty quickly, but we didn't know that was going to happen.
And then she had to work all these jobs, so she wasn't home very much. And so until you were old enough to really understand your mother's sacrifices and this long-range plan that she had to bring the family to America, in part for your benefit so that you could get an education and you could be free, you had a pretty fraught relationship with her and didn't really comprehend that she could do all this and be gone so much and love you.
Right, and I feel so badly about this now. I just had no concept of this as a child. I saw all these other families with their mom who would go with them to school. I saw my mother once a month because she had to go live at this college campus. And just to explain also how unusual this was, during the Cultural Revolution in China, education stopped. My mother, the last grade that she went to before the Cultural Revolution was the fifth grade. And so she wasn't even supposed to be studying, but because of her mother, my grandmother, smuggled in books that they read by candlelight at night. And then my mother beat out many, many people across the country to be in one of the first classes to enter university. But she hadn't gone to any class before she entered university. And so because it was such an honor to be able to do that, there was no other option. I mean, you just have to live on campus. Of course, I understand that now. And I understand also in the U.S., my mother was studying for a PhD while also working multiple jobs. Then when we moved to Los Angeles, she was earning a teaching certificate while working multiple jobs. So of course I never saw her, but I also resented her not being there. And as a result of us just not knowing each other well, we fought a lot when we did spend time together. And it wasn't until she got ill and I started going with her to her chemotherapy appointments and going to her doctor's visits that we really got to know one another.
You know, I'm trying to think about this from your mother's point of view, that she'd sacrificed so much for you. And you were just so impatient and angry with her so often.
I know.
That must have been really hard for her. Though it sounds like she wasn't exactly the huggy, touchy, feely type of mother.
No, and I mean, I said so many terrible things to my mother. And I had blocked it all out until I wrote this book, right? Because who wants to think about the terrible things that you said to your parents when you were young? But I remember saying to my mother, and I cannot believe this because this is so horrible. And I regret this forever. If my mother is listening somewhere, I hope she'll forgive me for this. But I remember saying to her, when I'm a mother one day, I want to be nothing like you. And I have tears in my eyes saying this because it's so horrible. I cannot imagine what my mother must have been thinking when she heard this, because she was trying to do her best as a working mom under very difficult circumstances. She was trying to keep our family together. I wish for nothing more than for her to somehow know that she has grandchildren who would have loved her very much.
Well, Dr. Lena Nguyen, thank you so much for talking with us, and stay healthy.
Thank you. You too, Terry.
Thank you very much. Dr. Lena Nguyen is the author of the new memoir, Lifelines, A Doctor's Journey in the Fight for Public Health. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with assistance from Charlie Kyer. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Terry Gross. Thank you.